The challenges so far, said Harrow carefully, have encouraged me to consider some striking possibilities. Right, but it's like, imagine if someone showed you a new sword move or whatever, but then you never actually got to sit down and read up on how it worked. It might give you ideas, but you wouldn't really learn it. Do you follow? Jean Marie, Gideon, and Camilla all stared at him. What? He said. The six learned sword fighting out of a book? Said Jean Marie, horrified. No, put in Camilla. The warden just hasn't been to Swordman's Spire since he was five and got lost. Okay. Flamities put his hands out. He was still holding the blood-stained spectacles. That was clearly an inopposite comparison, but a challenge taken purely as a necromantic exercise, said Hera calmly, suggests many things, but reveals none. Only the underlying theorem can lay bare the mystery.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, Episode 24, Megatherum.
It's really satisfying. Every time Nibirius gets owned.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's so
It's
good.
great to watch him be embarrassed.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He has maybe the most punchable face in literary history, in my opinion.
It's really up there.
Yeah. He like is an active contender for being a, a ranked member of that elite.
The heel turn for Corona Beth is really devastating, and it's lovely how subtle it is.
Yeah, it's like it's a sigh and a whimper in a way, in terms of it all happens very quickly internally and she deflates. But she's aware of it as it's happening. Like knowing that she's making a choice in this moment is like all over her body language.
The repetition of one another's language as an affirmation that they're on the same page is also, I thought, just so skillful. Because it's so realistic. Like I edit this out of the podcast a lot, but you and I do this to each other all the time, where we will just repeat something back as an affirmation, and it doesn't make for great. Like we don't need to say everything twice, but like it made me aware, having edited this, that's such a real practice, and you don't see it. I feel like I don't see it in scripts. I don't see it in novels. But like that, people do that.
Yeah, totally. It is, both I think subconsciously and a learned thing that you can do. Like, people will say it in general just to give it more space in the room and to give it more weight. They're like, I'm adding a second voice and I'm doubling the duration of time at which we are thinking and focusing and centering on this phrase. There's this very descriptive language going into this too as well. So it also does that thing where, Muir is kind of shifting the way we perceive time and it's like slowing down to really observe Corona in this moment. And then this repetition happens, which like hasn't happened really. There isn't been a lot of like repetition as a tool in the writing in the book so far. So it stands out for that reason too.
It really does. And it's so thematic with them, as so many times Ianthe has been described as sort of the shadow of Corona, or as her reflection. And it puts Corona as the original and Ianthe as the second. And this subverts that. And it's like, no, Ianthe is actually the one who's in charge.
And the fact that Ianthe's body language, Ianthe's manner has never really changed since the beginning of the book. She's just a bit more verbal now, if anything. Like, also conveys the fact that she's been her doing her thing the whole time. Like, Corona is the one who is massively transformed by everyone no seeing that this is a choice. And maybe it's the kind of thing that like Camilla and if Judith and Marta were in the room would read, because I think for Gideon, like, she's picking up that something meaningful has just happened internally, but like she's quite a bit younger in a way that I think may not fully grasp the way this would feel for Corona, both in terms of her own self respect and her own relationship with herself, but also in terms of she's no longer able to maintain this illusion that her whole identity has been built around.
Yeah, and it's really a stark choice that Ianthe chooses to do this in public.
There's a kind of like cruel indifference, but also very calculated strategy to it in a way that is like so her.
Yeah.
And I love her because she's the worst. And so when I see stuff like this happening, I'm like, if I was a villain, this is the kind of shit that I would love to do.
Yeah, I really see this sort of as a performance of humiliation and as having a really intense meaning for their power relationship.
Yeah, and like I have had unfortunate moments in my own life where someone has done a power play of this kind where, language repetition and a public setting is used to establish a power dynamic, and it is brutal because you are aware that you're being played in the moment. So
Yeah.
there's an internal fight of like your own dignity and self-respect and autonomy, like trying to get through. But if there's a larger power structure that you've identified that you are like trapped in, essentially, there's kind of a resignation of like, I don't know how to get out of this. This like I'm here in this, and like yeah, there's a defeat that happens, and you just see where like Corona's body like essentially slumps over. Like she's turning it into this tender moment with Ianthe, which has its own weird vibes, but her body is just like giving up. She was this
Oh,
tall presence, and now she's so small.
yeah, and I think let's go ahead and like spotlight the vibes as well, that the physical intimacy of this moment is one of those things that does maybe point in the incest direction, but also there's something so babyish about like grasping at her hair while she's so distressed. And they're like their biting thing that they do when that like it's so infantile as well, and it has this like sexy baby element that's so creepy.
And like, with my first read through this, I did not notice this moment in that way. But once I had experienced the larger fan fiction culture, I was like, oh, I get why people pick this up. And it also like, in being, I think, appropriately disturbed by twincest as a word, I realized, something that someone had told me many, many years ago about the culture of fan fiction, which is like, the right that you have to write what you want is something that is respected. What you do with it after you have written it is also evaluated. Like, if you look at the culture of Archive of Their Own, which is a website that hosts an enormous amount of fan-written media, the way that they organize the content so that it is safe for people to come through and to look for different things is really, really managed. And like, this fandom is no exception. Like, there's a tag called Dead Dove Do Not Eat, and it has its own interesting history in terms of popular media, but it's often used where it's like, hey, we're touching on topics that are really, really troubling for some readers. I'm not apologizing for it. I'm telling you that it's there, is kind of the vibe. And there's this interesting, like, degree of transgression that is in the fan fiction of this fandom, like religious trauma, the intersection of religious trauma and intimacy, the relationship. Familial incest, both emotional and like physical. Like, there's all of these really transgressive themes that are present. But I think that speaks to the fact that like people are picking up on these clues. Like, this little moment between Ianthe and Corona, people who have experienced weird vibes in these ways that have deeply affected them resonate with this moment and are like, cool, I'm going to process with these characters. Like, and I didn't understand that until I started being exposed to these more taboo themes within the fan fiction culture.
I had like the opposite relationship, and I think it might just be because of like prior fiction experiences. Like for me, my first exposure to twincest was Game of Thrones. And so that like the first time that I read the first Game of Thrones book, which I think was like late high school, the whole idea of that as a possibility was horrifying and really startling to me. But having kind of been through that as a sort of fiction experience, I picked up on this immediately and was like, oh, that's what we're doing with the, that's part of their whole creepy vibe. Okay, got it. And it's been interesting as we've talked about this, that like, it almost doesn't bother me. Real actual incest bothers me a lot, but in the fictional universe, like that's not one of my hot buttons. And I, for whatever reason, like, I'm just like, oh yeah, like they're horrifying.
And I think to me, it highlights the difference between like, you know, the buttons that are culturally ingrained in me and the buttons that are based on personal experience. Like I find some of the things that happen in Harrow, some of the ways that John relates to Harrow are more personally activating and unsettling than like this weird moment that I have. Like it's a different type of reaction when it comes from cultural stigma versus personal experience. I think one of the things in talking about fandom made content is that like we expand our understanding of our relationship to like art. Mm-hmm. Like we learn our boundaries and our limits through like, there's so many different kinds of things out there made out of inspiration from this. And as a general fandom, we understand that not all of that is for everybody. Like your cosplay that has a massive gaping hole in your chest with teeth and like it's really raw and quite body horror, like it deeply upsets me. I don't look at it very much. I don't want to look at it very much, but I appreciate it as artwork. But like, I'm uncomfortable with your art, Han.
Yeah.
And while I think that, you know, there's a broad spectrum in terms of distress and discomfort and how we relate to art, like I do want to think that fandom is a place that a lot of people learn the language to navigate that. Because I certainly like within my relationship to the art from these books, like, have absolutely expanded my literacy and my ability to communicate my own boundaries. These girls are weird. Ianthe is the worst, and I love her. Han does a Corona Beth cosplay, and I do Ianthe cosplay. But those two cosplays have actually never met.
Yeah. We did a duet one time.
But they haven't been in person.
No, not in person.
Which is just going to be like the day that happens is we're just going to be like, how?
Yeah, we're going to really find some stuff out that day.
We will probably make some kind of internet material out of it.
Mm-hmm. So Nibirius challenges the sixth, despite the fact that they're wounded and he has no real reason to. And he has now got the backing of both of the princesses. And Harrow and Jean-Marie offer to give him his ass. And I think it's very cool that both of them do this with these very house-specific sort of statements, these catchphrases. And Harrow Hark says, death first to vultures and scavengers. And Jean-Marie says, fidelity in the emperor. I want to dig into this first one because this is one of those things that like, if you have TLT merch, there's like a 20% chance that this is on it.
I could probably like, I probably have a sticker that says that within like 10 feet of me right now.
I have to tell you, when I discovered that this was like one of the big merch things, I was baffled.
No, maybe, but it's that or One Flesh, One End. It's going to be one of the two.
Go Loud, very, very popular, which, sure, absolutely. Yeah. The reason that I didn't connect with this is that it didn't make sense to me on the surface. But then when I started to sort of dig into it, it made more sense to me. Because You don't death first to vultures and scavengers is the opposite of what vultures and scavengers is like.
There's a lot that doesn't really inherently make sense in like, yeah, the first read of the scene that's painted there. It's like, not only does something have to die first for them to show up, but also they're a necessary part of the ecosystem to prevent like that death from turning into a mass death of things that are in the proximity of the first one.
This is what I was thinking, is I was like, no, usually there's a death and then there's vultures and scavengers. And also vultures and scavengers, yeah, a natural, normal part of the ecosystem. But then I was like, okay, well, who wouldn't be down for vultures and scavengers? People who want the body.
So they have disrupted this cycle, and they have to keep it disrupted to continue their role in it.
Yeah. I was like, normally a sort of death cult would have a positive affinity with animals associated with death because vultures and scavengers are part of the natural death cycle. But
Yeah.
necromancy is not part of the natural death cycle. Necromancy is a diversion from the natural process. And so, as far as
Yeah.
Harrowhark is concerned, vultures and scavengers are like thieves.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting too if you think of it like in the ecological context, if you're like justifying necromancy as a stage in a larger like balanced pattern, like you've now inserted this anthropocenic new stage of an ecosystem that like it would be kind of interesting to be like, okay, so if you just got rid of the necromancy, how would things rebalance? Like it's just like it causes such what seems to be a like cumulative destruction, a cumulative consumption that has no recycle to it. There's no end to which like, you know, metaphor for capital, like, you know, like empirical capitalism themes. Like it's all that really ties in. Like the relationship between like division from community and division from death and division from like sustainable like ideologies and the way that death shows up. And soon as you're like, actually, no, we're going to be hyper focusing all our resources in one demographic, you need to control death to do that.
Yeah, and it feels like there's such a close connection between this sort of like scapegoating carrion eaters and this like pressure to create this quest for immortality. Like, she is part of a death cult that sort of reviles death at the same time. And it has, you know, really, as you say, interesting ecological implications and ideological implications. And the fact that she's got this like death first to vultures and scavengers, I'm like, bro, is your soil okay?
Yeah. Like I would, if there's anyone out there who's like a microbiologist who wants to talk about like Thanergy and Thallergy and microbiology, like please get in touch. I want you on our podcast because like the relationship between ecology and necromancy seems really like intense. We talk about it within the, you know, people because we can follow the story of people, but you know, when we talk about like the resurrection beasts, like one can only assume a resurrection beast is made up of all the life of a whole planet, which includes all everything that might have lived in that biomass, which like now you have a whole other type of entity that like the way it like we have this visual of, you know, you suck the soul out, you put it somewhere else for a bit, and now there's a bunch of Thallergy trying to come in, and then you can use that for magic. Fucked up, but okay. Like, if you have an entire planet's worth of biomass, playing with those fluid dynamics, like it may not behave the same way as like a human soul, or it may behave that way at a whole other scale. Like, there's all these interesting, like in terms of ecological crashes. Like what it would have to sustain to prevent ecological crash at the level that would like ruin food supply, have a deep devastating effect on oxygen and carbon recycling. Like there's all these things you'd have to artificially reproduce while this Thallergy current was like spiraling up out as a vacuum from from creating the resurrection beast.
Silas's whole thing about the sixth is something that I really just glossed over at first. And it's so weird.
And it suggests that Silas knows additional things about Palamedes and the sixth, and implicitly Camilla as well. He obviously doesn't know something, but he's like, I know enough about you to make suggestions about her. And there's like, okay, how many different groups got dossiers on everybody else?
Yeah. It really suggests that. And I think on first reading, I was like, oh, he's just an asshole, whatever. But then, the stuff that he knows about Gideon is real stuff. And so knowing that he like actually knows about Gideon makes me then come back to this, like, okay, hold on. What does all this mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I don't know what unfinished is doing in this sentence.
I really enjoy this world building because it doesn't really ever give us much else to build on that.
Silas calls Palamedes an unfinished inbred who passed an examination. And we know that the examination is part of the process of how he became in the position that he is in the house. Inbred, we know that there's a genetic bottleneck event in the sixth. They have trouble with managing genetic health. They have some sort of very long established eugenics program. That all makes sense. But what is unfinished? Unfinished in what sense? Like, he hasn't been to etiquette and hygiene school? Like, what are we talking about?
There's a part of me, like, at the pettiest level, and I don't think this is what it is, but the first thing came to mind is just, like, is he just older than Palamedes, and he just wants to be, like, you know, I'll tell you when you're older, like, a little bit of a dick about it. But, like, I would more, you know, deeply scratching at the surface, from the surface there, is like, the eugenics program of the sixth is unfinished. They're still struggling to deal with a population drop and some kind of, you know, functional hierarchy succession.
I don't know what it means to say that a person is unfinished.
The main technology we've experienced in this book so far that modifies people is necromancy.
Mm-hmm.
But we implicitly have eugenics examples in the case of Column. So, like, Silas is very familiar with a certain type of eugenics. And clearly approves of it. Like, Column is pro-eugenics. Silas is pro-eugenics because he is perfectly comfortable with who and what Column is. Does that mean that there is, like with the necromancy, divisions of opinions and taboo about different types of eugenics between the houses, which is entirely possible? Or is he just thinks that the seventh house eugenics is better than the sixth house eugenics?
I don't think anybody objects to the eugenics at any stage.
But is there a hierarchy in the same way that, like, there's a perceived hierarchy? Each house is like, this is where you fit in the ranking. And they don't agree about, like, whose necromancy is better than whose, but they all have an opinion that somehow puts the different types of necromancy in a hierarchy. Here's another much more mundane possibility. Maybe it's simply that, like, there is a process by which one develops as the warden, and he's just young and hasn't finished it. Like, his training is incomplete.
So, yeah, like, maybe.
Because, yes, as a person, you're static, but as a person in a role, your relationship to that role and the skills and practices that you apply to it, absolutely are not. Especially if it's like a standardized role that involves examination, then there's also training and learning involved too. And I wonder if that's kind of the dig, is like, his education is incomplete. It's almost like tedious in terms of like how like unexciting that interpretation of it is, but it's also like really quite a simple way of interpreting it.
Yeah. Yeah. That would make sense.
Yeah, and I think my hesitation is it's not like nasty in the way that I would normally associate Silas to be nasty. Like I wouldn't expect him to dig at someone because their education, like that's like he would. I could see him digging at someone for other reasons, but that just doesn't like seem like a thing that he normally attacks. But I mean, yeah, I don't know, maybe.
And then the thing he says about Camilla, comparing her to a mad dog, could comment on her fighting. But
I think it's a comment on her fighting, for sure.
the I doubt her legal claim to the title of Cavalier Primary. I'm like, I want to know so much about that. What is happening with that statement?
Yeah, totally. So in the ninth, it's passed down hereditarily, and so is the case in the fourth. Prince Nibirius implies that that's also hereditary in the third. Though sometimes that can be assigned after the fact if you like come into a role from the outside and then you're, crowned. So either he's implying that she's a usurper of some kind or that she's a bastard, like doesn't claim it in the hereditary way. And I mean bastard in a very like much looser sense than just like born out of wedlock, but more like born out of the protocols of the hereditary practices.
Yeah, it would be interesting if we got more information about that, like what her relationship with Cavalierhood is.
Yeah, because she certainly seems to like it.
And the additional materials suggest that she's been in the role for a while, so it's not like a Gideon situation.
Yeah, and her relationship with Pal also. I think the question I think if I could only ask one is like, was their relationship pre-existing before she was Cavalier? That's the question. If I could only have one answered, that one I think I would find the most time. I could chew on it for the longest.
I think that there's insight about that in the Dr. Sex short story, but I
Okay.
can't remember what the actual details are.
All right, Silas is a dick.
Silas is a dick.
The ways in which he's a dick is fascinatingly world building, leaving some open-ended questions that, in terms of like ways to world build, this is a way that I really like. Like weird, open-ended, not contextualized with any other, passages in the book, just interpersonal cattiness. Like I actually really love, and this is, simple enough that we can, speculate on it through kind of what we understand about the world we live in, rather than it being like referring to some larger structure that is fictional. We can be like, okay, there's these different relationships that are already used within the structure of the metaphors of the houses from our world and our understanding of history. So it's a good mix between that, like, I'm not going to tell you anything more about it, but also you have information that you can speculate pretty satisfyingly. Like,
Yeah,
because you
and
can go too far one of those way directions.
I think that there's also something of that in this just like really quick kind of couplet between Nibirius complaining that he should have stayed home and gotten married, and Ianthe being like no one was even offering. Because as you know, others have pointed out, that's not a story about him wishing that he'd stayed home with his beloved.
Totally. And it's also, Ianthe again publicly humiliating Nibirius to remind him that while he, yeah, you stood up on the table and you challenged the six for your keys and you had your curl in the middle of your face and oh, you look so big and tough and you're still my fucking bitch, Babs.
Yeah.
No one gave a fuck about you there and no one cares about you here, so stop being so full of yourself.
Yeah.
Like it's this like really shitty moment when like at this point everyone hates him and no one's scared of him anymore. Like he's lost a lot of power.
And I think despite the fact that Iante has really pressed the advantage with both him and Coronabeth in this moment, she also has tipped her hand in this scene without having
Yes.
gotten anything material out of it. So I think her pissiness is pretty genuine in that moment.
She just like she's mad that this whole situation is like making her job more complicated, and like now she doesn't have the same power in this context that she did. Man, if this is how shitty she is in public, I imagine she's worse in private.
Yeah, I bet she's a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, for real. And then we come to my favorite part of this chapter where Pal gets roasted.
So, Claire, this is such an interesting scene, having had previous mentions of manualized sword fighting in the book. So, when I first read this, I was like, oh, that's interesting. They don't have sword manuals in this world. But then on this reread, Gideon mentions sword fighting manuals. So that makes this moment, I think, even more interesting. So, what are they getting wrong? What is Pal getting wrong about how to learn sword fighting from a book?
So the main problem with a book is that pictures don't move. And also they're flat in general. So and they don't show anything about acceleration. They don't show really much about what's happening internally within the body, and they don't show what's happening mentally, which are all pretty fucking critical in terms of a sword move. So as a sport, sword fighting that doesn't come from an unbroken tradition is trying to reverse engineer things from books. And like we do have unbroken sword fighting traditions, which are interesting in contrast, but there's a lot of study from, recovered manuals that are basically drawings of books plus really interesting language trying to describe movement with very few words, because these books often come from times when making a book was incredibly labor intensive, both with materials and with human labor. These books were not, with the exclusion of maybe one much, much later on, what we considered like sword fighting manuals that are outside of military contexts are usually private documents used as reference material to someone who already knows a little bit about the foundations of what we're talking about. Sort of how, like, historic cooking books lean on a lot of pre-existing knowledge that they assume the cooks already have over what a wine sauce might be, over what a gravy could mean, because those things are different now than they were in the context of these books. Even books written about how to sword fight now are still limited by these things. They're still limited by a lack of movement, a lack of space on a page to describe what's going on that also balances with the amount of cognitive effort you're doing by thinking about how your body is moving. Like, how different martial art traditions have tried to translate their movement into images and words, like, is interesting, because some of them use geometry to express it, some of them use poetry to express it, some of them use metaphors about different types of animals to try and capture this. But at the end of the day, unless your body is moving, you're not going to understand it, because your body is a unique expression of these things that cannot be articulated by someone else.
So what Palamedes is getting wrong in this moment is not that a book can be involved with learning sword fighting, but that a book is what gets you the real understanding. That first you might see it in real life and play around with it, but really it's the book that's going to unlock it. Whereas it's kind of the reverse, where you might look at the book and get a sense of it, but you're not going to really grasp it until you're physically doing it.
Yeah, and practically, the way this might have looked in my sports in the last 10 years is I'll be at a tournament, I'll see someone do something cool. And I'm like, that was rad. And I'll go over to them and I'll say, "Hey, that thing you did was cool. Tell me about that." And they'll say, "Oh, this is from, Agrippa or Fiore or Lichtenauer." Like, there's all these different people whose names are associated with these books. And so they'll be able to tell me a book. And then they'll be able to tell me a picture, and they'll be able to tell me a page. So now I have a picture and some words. But unless they physically show me their individual interpretation of that motion, my body has no experience of it. Which means that if I try and reproduce it, I'm doing it from the picture and the words with a person who wasn't there to see the thing, or maybe was there to see the thing. And that is a much more trial and error process than someone who knows something sharing an already known embodied knowledge. Like the learning process is very different between that. There's so many more gaps to fill when you're just doing with words and a picture. And like that is usually only made up through repetition. And it's interesting because in terms of like learning physical skills, there's a really interesting conversation there because there's like, knot tying. You can show diagrams of knots, you can show sequences of movement of that string, but you can't really convey the feeling of tension in different sections of that knot that need to be established so that you can, cinch it up at the final time with everything coming together perfectly balanced. Because if one section is too loose and one section is too tight, when you try and cinch it at the end, it's not going to work. It's going to get kind of weird and lumpy. Like these are things that only physical sensory experience can convey and internalize. You can teach it in person by setting it up and allowing someone to touch it and feeling that. But no amount of diagram in a book is really going to get the sensation of, okay, I'm going to push back this rope just a little bit so it bulks out, but also slacks up. And this slacks through here so that I can adjust this at this last moment to make sure it's going to be balanced when I pull it taut. There's so much information you can get at a theory level from reading books. Like I read a ton about wilderness survival as a kid. It was like a big interest of mine. And like I can tell you how to make like six different shelters in nature with just a hatchet. But like I would not be able to make any of those efficiently. I would not be able to tell you how to evaluate finding a good spot for doing those, like what's a good spot for that particular type of shelter, what types of trees are good for making that type of shelter versus what type of like ground materials. Those things come from experience. Sensory knowledge is not conveyed through books. Do you think the fourth is still waiting for the fifth before they really get their facility key? Do you think like they're just going to not pursue going down in the facility whatsoever? Like theoretically, should they have the opportunity, they would wait until some future point? Or do you think that thing of Abigail being like, "Hey, wait for us," they're still in some way holding to that?
I think yes, it's been a very short amount of time, and breaking with a promise to somebody who died is a kind of acknowledgement that's a big acknowledgement. And I think, given a lot of time, they would eventually, kind of come to things have changed and we need to make new decisions. But I think not days later.
Because it's interesting because it adds a little bit of tailoring to their motivation compared to some of the other people in these scenes. Them and Judith and Marta are not really planning on going down. And that just kind of like shifts the dynamic in a little bit in terms of what their priorities are.
But they do really want to hunt whatever killed the fifth. And so, obviously in this scene, they come up with the plan to split the party and have half of the group stay at Kithiraea's bedside and half of the group go down into the facility to look for the missing Protesilaus. And they're totally down for that. Their only hesitation is that they want to prioritize, looking after whoever hurt the fifth rather than trying to solve the seventh issue.
They split the party, always a great start to a plot line. That always goes well for just about everyone who's ever done it.
Yeah, in a horror movie, you should definitely create as small a group as you can.
Especially make it a group that involves creating a new group dynamic that the party members are not familiar with whatsoever, that they have to figure out on the fly as they go into a situation that's definitely not going to be more stressful than the one they're already in.
So Pal suggests that the fourth and Gideon stay with Kithiraea, but Harrow insists that it's the other way.
The question of who knows what just from vibes is becoming increasingly striking because, like, at this point, we're pretty sure Harrow has clocked that something is weird about Protesilaus. She has not had a chance to really investigate Kithraea.
So she does have Protesilaus's head in her closet right now.
Harrow.
Harrow does.
Harrow does.
Harrow does.
I could ask where she got it from, but I know I'm going to find out in due time. So she doesn't give a fuck where Protesilaus's body is because she has what she needs.
So her concern is that if the Fourth and Gideon stay with Kithaera, Kithaera might kill them. But she knows that Kithaera isn't going to kill them in the basement because she's going to be with Kithaera. Unfortunately, that's not how Kithaera works. I love that Palamedes understands that he is trying to resocialize a wild animal. And so he's like, I am doing a trust gesture at you. It's a relational thing.
I also imagine some of the way that Palamedes is approaching Harrow might have to do with some of the ways he initially relationship built with Camilla.
Oh, Camilla was a rescue.
You fight like Camilla fights if you grew up okay?
Okay, that rude.
Camilla's probably a rescue, which honestly would contextualize Silas's comment like really quite neatly, which says interesting things about political dynamics in the sixth. So, okay, our parties now are Palamedes, Camilla, and Gideon.
Palamedes, Camilla, and Harrow are going to stay with Kithaera.
Palamedes, Camilla, and Harrow are with Kithraea,
And then Isaac,
which.
Jean-Marie, and Gideon are going into the basement.
Oh no. I thought they had one more good card in their hand.
No, they don't.
This is the worst way to stack the deck. This is the worst. It's gonna suck soon.
Yeah, real for very soon. And Palamedes asks them if that's okay with them. And Jean-Marie says the stories about the ninth house seem probably bullshit.
I love Jean-Marie so much.
I
I
want
want
to
to
know what the stories are.
So we have like visceral horror and refusal to eat around them. So something to do with what is eaten is taboo, or there's like some sort of contamination thing.
But that's the eighth, and they know about the shuttle, and they know about the children.
Okay. So just the sheer like horror of what someone is sufficient. I guess it's, not so much which specific taboos are being violated, but the degree of taboo being violated that the eighth is reacting to there.
I mean, would you sit and just like casually have dinner with somebody who did genocide?
Out of curiosity, I would do it one time, but that's not the situation. That's just casual breakfast as equals, which I would not do.
And he doesn't think that Gideon did it, but he thinks that she is in service to a house that recently perpetrated genocide. And I think that like being like, gross, I'm not sitting with you, pretty normal. And being hostile about it, pretty normal.
Pretty normal. And I think that's one of those things where it's like, the eighth is portrayed as this like shitty, like slimy assholery, but it's like actually some of the things that they're reacting to is pretty okay.
Yeah, it's just that
Like,
Gideon doesn't know about it yet. And when it becomes clear to them that she doesn't know, they just tell her, which is pretty solid. They do then try to kill her, but not all the way solid.
And I think that's, we've talked about this before, like when you scratch the surface of the houses, like despite with some of these like initially likable characters, you really do start to see the dichotomy of what their necromancy, what their political and social standing has made normal and justified. And there is a lot of like, this is how we want you to see us. And having a revulsion at some of the things that the eighth is having revulsion towards is in contrast with some of the things that, for example, the second and the fourth need to be fine with, which in this case is genocide, because that's what they're doing.
Yes, although I would sort of like bring up some amisas there here that like the way people feel about genocide really depends on who's the victim of it.
Yeah. And so, you know, even in Harrow, we don't really get, and it isn't until Nona that we really get a picture of how that starts to be divided socially, of the us versus them, and who's worthy of protection under the empire and who is not. And, you know, obviously how fragile that definition is, depending on how the people in power see you. I'm curious if with Electo we're gonna get more on that, or if we're gonna stay within the lens of being embedded inside the empirical mechanisms, because Nona gives us this picture from the other side that has a very different vibe. And so I'm curious how those two different perspectives are going to play, because how we feel and how we're presented things like, you know, casual genocide, or, you know, just in general, different types of dehumanization, we can see the same picture from two different, you know, like I love Jean-Marie and Isaac. Mostly Jean-Marie, but also Jean-Marie is the one that actively benefits from dead people. Like the dead people juice goes into Jean-Marie, so she gets bigger and stronger.
We don't know that they do that.
Oh, it's just the second.
It could just be the second.
It could just be the second. I would have a hard time believing it was exclusive to the second, but we have established that the fourth has big families.
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah.
I think we just don't really get details about sort of exactly what combat looks like for them. We definitely don't get any like express indication that they're up to that. It's possible, but it's not.
Yeah, we don't get a lot of like really specific information about Isaac's necromancy in general.
The only thing we see him doing is wards.
Aww, if they were no, they're not mostly defensive. That's
They're not.
they're not. I
No.
romanticized that for a second. And I was like,
Nah.
nah,
That's
nah.
not what's up.
They are child soldiers.
No, they are for sure. I found it noteworthy how Palamedes addresses his comrades in this moment because he does not use their names at all. He addresses Fourth as Fourth, and he addresses Gideon as Ninth Cavalier, which feels very distant and formal.
How does he refer to Hera when he's like, hey, this is a trust exercise? I trust you. I trust the Reverend Daughter, Hera Harkonnen of Jesimus. So that is not intimate.
It's not intimate, but it does have a name.
It has a name, and there's something about, I think, saying it that way that is almost supplicant. Like he's referring to the ways in which she's elevated, including the, you know, the long name, the title, the article of the, you know, this, all of this, like layers and layers of deference that Ninth Cavalier does not have. It's not the Ninth Cavalier. It's not Ninth Cavalier Gideon Nav. It's not, you know, both titles of the ninth, but treated very differently.
And I think he said something really similar in the previous chapter where he referred, or maybe not the previous chapter, in the chapter with the Cremains, I think he referred to Isaac as Baron Tetteras. So
Yeah.
again, like a very, very formal, distant.
I think this is highlighting, and you know, also, you know, your right hand, my right hand, is highlighting some of the more, you know, unlikable, unsettling parts of what Palamedes sees as normal, which is that cavaliers are instrumental and in almost some ways a bit disposable. Their bodies are for the use of their adept. And their adept has more power and dignity and is more deserving of respect.
Yeah, and he sort of only checks in with Gideon as an afterthought, and he is kind of apologetic about having forgotten to do that. That he's like, oh yeah, I
Yeah.
guess like I should see if you're okay.
Yeah, it makes me think of, ways in which I've navigated like deprogramming, imperial status in my brain and how I talk to different people and how I acknowledge and identify different voices in the spaces that I'm in. Because sometimes you'll revert to these scripts that are super familiar because they're easy, and then you'll realize they are inherently dehumanizing. And you'll catch yourself. But the thing that I'm not clear on here, in this ongoing comparison to my own experience, is this him trying to change that in response to saying, okay, we actually have to work together, and I have to treat these people differently if we're going to successfully work together under these, newly threatening conditions? And he's like still kind of learning that process. Or is this like a genuine, like where in that process? Because obviously, like, he's fine with some dehumanization of Cavaliers, but he's not just defaulting to that strongly. There's a larger kind of gray fuzzy in terms of how he treats them. Like it shifts. Like, he's incredibly respectful and trusting of Cam. She's an enormous priority to him, but her body is at the end of the day an instrument for his purposes. But her opinion on how that looks matters to him.
Yeah, and he is more conservative with how he's willing to use her than Harrow is.
So to me, it says that this is a place where he is shifting in his life from what he was.
Yeah, I think that that sounds right because he doesn't seem confident as he's navigating these interactions, and that points to kind of a shift.
I would wonder if Palamedes is entertaining the theory that the social relationships that Magnus and Abigail were possibly fostering were a reason why they were a threat. Like, he's identified later in this chapter that one of the reasons why Kithareo or Dulcinea is in danger is just because she's vulnerable. He identifies that, like, why would someone target Magnus and Abigail? And I said earlier on in our episodes, because they were a catalyst for social unity. So in extending what they were offering, what they were trying to bring, like, he's trying to maybe carry some of that still, to see what the potential of continuing to apply that, continuing to, solicit and extend trust from the other houses as possible. Obviously, some houses have completely burned that bridge, but, like, this is a newer thing for him to be trying out, I think. And I wonder if Magnus and Abigail were a piece on why that shift is happening.
Gideon and Harrow hug.
Harrow just goes limp. And she says Nav. She uses her name rather than Griddle once she finds the ability to make words.
Yeah. Harrow feels really hot when Gideon touches her, and it's a clue because the lictors also run hot.
Ah, okay. So when you're like kind of overclocked for your meat form.
Yeah. It's all the ghosts in there.
So they're getting real high vibrations. Someone recently, it was this mathematician, her name was Sabine something, but talking about like particles as like a mathematical concept is a way of describing a phenomenon that we thought was happening and seeing if like our math models matched up with the tools that we built to see if our math models worked. It's not necessarily the way we conceptualize them. But when I think of like particles and like atomic vibrations and how vibration, molecular vibration creates heat, like I'm like, why not just ghosts ping-ponging within you? Like it just very maybe literally turns into heat. Because like I can't imagine Thanergy and Thallergy without some sort of like sensory temperature, smell, like movement, like coding that often is associated with energies of different types, like either, a positive charge or a negative charge, or, a differential between heat and cool causing movement. And I understand that like necromancy may not be based on any of these metaphors, but I have such a hard time letting them go. So like, especially with this, where it's like someone with a lot of souls in them runs physically hot. How do we get temperature? From vibration. Like actually from stuff vibrating a whole lot. So if you're like pack a whole bunch of souls in a container that's only designed to hold one, ghost science on why Harrow's so weird. And then Jean-Marie immediately clocks how weird that was. She's like, You cool? Like you, that was, what's that? What's going on there? And why is it a weird thing to ask? Because that says something about how long these partnerships normally are established. Like, or because Magnus and Abigail were married before he was cavalier.
Or at least romantically attached before he was cavalier. Yeah.
So, would that mean that she had a different cavalier prior? And maybe they were betrothed, and then that cavalier died, and he happened to also be in the line of succession, but it was fine when she had a different cavalier. Yeah, this again brings in the question of like, what are norms across the empire versus very regional house specific norms? I'm seeing a pattern of like regional of house specific norms, but with some consistent threads, and those consistent threads are what works for John's goals.
Yeah, it does seem that there's some variety in terms of when people get paired with cavaliers. And so it's a sensible question to ask. It's a thing that could have a large variety of answers because we know that in any case, Abigail and Magnus were paired as adults, whereas Jean-Marie and Isaac were paired as children. And there is clearly variety in that. The eighth were paired literally before Silas was born. Or at least, all of the brothers were waiting to see which one would be paired to him.
So there's a degree to which it is agreement to necromancy, and there's also a degree to which there's a succession, because like Jean Marie's family have been identified as, legendary in terms of fighters and cavaliers. I also want to recognize some of the lovely ways that Jean Marie is identified through like her Maori hair, because you have these different like ways in which she's described. And so I did some fan art for one of our episodes of Jean Marie and Magnus. And so I had to do a bunch of research into Samoan culture and Maori culture and athletic hairstyles used by teams from those regions. And it started to make me notice more about how she's described and how she's perceived with her hair as a big component of that. Because when they first find the cremains in the incinerator, it describes this halo. So like her hair, which is normally in some type of protective style, hasn't been recently styled in a while. She's been like frantic. And so a common, thing with that is that your hair comes out of whatever stylings it is in, and having the kind of hair texture that she would, halo makes sense. And then there's another reference to it earlier on in this chapter, but then we have this really, again, the contrasts that happen. Harrow's like, don't make this weird. And Isaac is literally braiding her hair to keep it safely away from whatever they have to do next. Like it's a 1-2. And then suddenly it's like, the question is, why are you guys weird? Like Isaac's braiding my hair. Like I'm not even thinking about this. And like you guys just hugged like it was like the first time you've ever done that. There's a real tenderness in braiding someone's hair away, and but also really highlighting the fact that like her hair is extremely textured. Like it's part of, I could see the different types of care behaviors between necromancer and cavalier, not just being about their necromancy, but also like their individuality. Palamedes being like, how dare you suggest Camilla couldn't fuck you up? Go loud, like.
I think Isaac braiding Jean-Marie's hair is also such an inversion of the power dynamic of service to the necromancer because she's the cav and he is doing this domestic care of her, which I think, reflects in some ways their relationship with the fifth, which is more mutual than Cav Necro dynamics often are, and they would have seen mutual care.
Yeah, absolutely. In a way, a tenderness that maybe just not part of the lore and the general understanding of the way that a necromancer and a cavalier would be across the empire, across all the houses. There's probably, a general I think the same way that you might imagine the relationship between, like, I don't think of a relationship that has any kind of really similar parallel to Necromancer and Cav in the real world.
I mean, it really
Outside of.
depends on which Necro and which Cav, because some
I
of
yeah.
them feel very much, like a body man, a sort of some combination of a butler and a bodyguard kind of thing. But some of them really do not feel like a servant kind of role at all.
Yeah. Yeah, and some of those relationships are so set up in what that dynamic is that it's a tell on Gideon's part that Gideon is not that. You know, like early on, Nibiris is like, "Who the fuck are you?" Because you are not a Ninth Cavalier. You know, we have that description still on the Ninth, talking about Ordis's father. And that's drilled in when Babs brings it up, and he's like, "I know what Ninth Cavaliers look like." You know, so I imagine for the Eighth, that's probably also similar. There's probably a larger understanding of that relationship. For the Second, it seems like there's also a larger understanding of that relationship.
And Gideon is really kind of meditating on that Cav Necro relationship as they split off and head towards the facility, where she's really thinking about what duty means between a Cav and a Necro, and between a Necro and a Cav.
Sweet.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaley and edited by Han Kaley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Our cover art is a sword fighting manual. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Check out the stuff in the show notes. Thanks for listening.